gonna be the very best, like no one ever was. To catch them is my real test, to train them is my call. I will travel across the land, searching far and wide, each Pokemon to understand the power that's inside. Pokemon, it's you and me. In a world we must defend, Pokemon, our heart's so true, our courage will pull us through. You teach me and I'll teach you. Pokemon, gotta catch you. Oh.
Yes, well, we are live from the Audubon Street Studios of WNPR in New Haven, where there's a lot of people on the streets. I assume they're all playing Pokemon Go. They're actually, I'm not making it up, though. It just, as I was coming in here today, there seemed to be a lot of people wandering around at least this part of New Haven. And they look like they don't belong here, so maybe they are all playing Pokemon Go. We're going to find out. We may not find out that, but we're going to find out many things from our panelists here on The Nose today. Let me tell you who they are. Lucy Gelman is a reporter for the New Haven Independent and station manager at WNHH. She's making her Nose debut today. We're very excited. Mark Oppenheimer is a veteran of The Nose, and he's more importantly editor-at-large for Tablet Magazine and host of his own podcast, his terrific podcast, on which I have been lucky enough to appear, Unorthodox. And he also is like the busiest guy in American journalism and the most productive guy in American journalism. Mercy Quay is one of our stalwarts here in New Haven. Now she's director of communication for New Haven Public Schools. A little bit later in the show, we will talk about the story of Corey Menefee, who smashed a stained glass window at Calhoun College. We'll also talk, I think kind of relatedly, about a very short essay by a guy named Vincent Cunningham, a fairly new writer for The New Yorker, about the collapse of our common American language for talking about things that are very important and about which we disagree. But for starters, we will talk about the craze that has existed for, I believe, exactly 1 week and is already in the process of ruining America. and so that's too judgmental. I don't want to say that. I want the panel to decide about this. But Lucy, it was kind of interesting because we started emailing back and forth, and I think it says something about the acceleration of modern life that you were saying, well, I don't know, is this like, has the sell-by date of this particular story already passed? I think the game was introduced last Friday, but you sort of had a point, right? Right? I mean, when the New York Times has it on page one, you know that you're now on the trailing edge as opposed to the leading edge.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to say two things about Pokemon Go. I think I have a lot of friends who have been playing it, not just in New Haven, but all around the country where they've spread out from sort of high school and college friends. And they've all said the same thing, which is that there's a great nostalgia kind of linked with playing Pokemon Go. And Colin, you've said before, we love something when it's dead or when it's almost dead. And so I think there's something of that there.
So their nostalgia is for Pokemon?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a card game?
A card game, TV show, yeah.
Showing my age here. I remember what it was, and one of them was named Pikachu.
Right. Yeah. And they're also real, and they're in zoos, too. Let's be clear.
Anyway, yeah, right. Right. Like jackalopes. Yeah.
And so I mean, I think augmented reality is really, really an interesting thing. And with Pokemon Go, in theory, I was really excited about this thing that got people out of their comfort zones, not just out of their houses and apartments. But, you know, if we're talking about New Haven, it's still an extremely segregated city and very much a tale of two cities. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh, if this is the push that's going to get Yale kids walking into Dixwell and into Fairhaven and seeing how great these neighborhoods are, or if this is the thing that's going to get people onto the New Haven green, and then they can look up and look around them and see the civic space, that's really exciting. In reality, I ran into a lot of people. So probably now about 8 people I've run into, or some of them have literally run into me while I've been reporting on the beat downtown in New Haven. And it's great that they're downtown, except all of them are looking at their phones and they have no idea what's around them. I had 2 people say to me last Sunday when I was at a protest, we're looking for the center church on the green. And I thought, this is great because it's a beautiful old church. And they said, oh, no, we're going because we want to catch some Pokemon. So I'm not crazy about it. I think it was WNPR's Tucker Ives who first said Pokemon no, or that was the first the first iteration that I saw. And I've got to agree with him there.
It was a Beach Boys song, too, I think. But first of all, maybe we need to explain. So, Mercy, you're fresh off the Pokemon fields, right?
Yeah.
You actually walked up here from another part of town, just Pokemon going all the way.
She Pokemon went.
And so, first of all, for people who have no idea what we're talking about, people like Avi who can barely remember the first
this
iteration.
Involves a smartphone, right?
Explain what it is you were doing.
Okay, so I this was even though I'm familiar with Pokemon, and even though I watched the TV show, played the video game, and collected the cards, I want to say hundreds and hundreds of Pokemon cards that I eventually had to get rid of because of church and other things that got in the way, school, things that actually maybe might have considered me, a Pokemon addict, right? Because I could no longer operate in life. Even though I had been familiar with this in the 90s and the early 2000s, today was the first time that I downloaded it, and I walked from Meadow Street all the way down here just to see what, the hoopla was about. And I want to say that is dangerous, and I do not Pokemon going and walking. I don't endorse that. I think that
you're saying basically one open manhole cover, and you wouldn't be on this show.
Exactly. I'm surprised I got here. I walked here with someone who was sort of watching out for my best interest. But I can't thank him enough for alerting me to branches that I was almost going to walk into, or the fact that the light had turned green. Right. There were times where I just was not – there was a Pokemon across the street, and I had to get across the street. And, I had only opened – because there's – it alerts you
there
to –
There will be Pokemon deaths, right? Oh, I mean, it's – no, I'm serious.
No, I'm serious. People are going to
– Already, actually.
There's been a Pokemon go death?
Well, I mean, not a death, but injuries, right? So two men –
Maiming?
Two men fell off a cliff. Where was this?
This was in California.
Right. Yeah. Two men fell off a cliff earlier today, and, I mean, I don't know if you can count this as a Pokemon death, but – a woman in Wyoming stumbled upon a dead body while she was Pokemon going. It's a verb now.
This is, to be clear, I did download it this morning. Shall I explain what this is for the people who have no idea?
I thought you just did that.
My bad.
No. She did not just do that. She's too deep in the culture.
It's true.
Look at her. What are you, 25 years old?
Yeah.
God.
Did I younger, older?
We played this game last time she was here.
Yeah. This is my favorite game.
How old are you?
25.
Oh, I nailed it.
You did.
Right. Okay, there. I'm very good. All right, so good.
She's drunk deep from the Pokemon chalice.
She was like actually raised by Pokemon. I mean, that's her generation, right? So this is intuitive to her. But so you take your smartphone. It accesses your camera. You hold the phone in front of you, and it actually takes pictures of the street scene in front of you. So you look in the camera, but it's as if you're looking at the street scene. Mm-hmm. So it's as if they're glasses that you're looking through. And right?
No.
And then there's little Poke people who appear in it so that it's – Yeah, right.
Did you download the right app? Did I download the right app?
Yeah, that's what it is, right, Colin?
I don't know. I was
you haven't played it anyway. So my understanding when I downloaded Pokemon Go,
somebody call in and say who's right.
Was it that augmented reality is you're looking at actual reality because your phone is taking a picture of the actual stuff in front of you, but then they put stuff in it. So there's little Poke people, little cartoon characters appear in your sight, so you can actually walk down the street, the sidewalk, and it's the real sidewalk of West Rock Avenue in my case, but with Poke people in it.
That's incredibly
interesting.
What did
you think you were doing?
No. My app, it was all VR, right? There was nothing that, you could – there was no mistaking that you were in a video game, and everything was –
So you didn't enable the camera.
Oh, is that
if
what
you
it
enable
is?
The camera,
I was looking down
pictures.
The whole time.
Right.
Every time, and as you're looking down, if I'm passing through
you
something.
You really took your life in your hands.
Yes.
Because you're actually in the video. You were in Pac-Man. Your screen looked like Pac-Man. And
exactly.
My screen, if you enable the camera, it takes pictures of the real street in front of you.
Well, so I think that's more dangerous.
Well, unclear. Anyway, here's what I want to say. I was bored with this after about 12 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I that's no disrespect to the Poke players and
none
the Poke
taken.
Goers,
yeah.
But I do think this is one of those things. And I should say I'm not a pop culture snob. I watch the trashiest TV in the world, but I'm not a video game person. And when I see those statistics, it's something like 57% of adult males play 4 hours of video games a week. I don't know one of them. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there's all kinds of segregation in our society. And I don't mean to trivialize the important kinds, like economic, racial, etc., which I report on at a very. But seriously, like something like grown adults who sit around playing video games, that's a whole segment. I don't even know those people.
Well, the reason why you don't know any of them is because Pokemon and video gaming in general, that culture, that's an incredibly introverted culture. You're probably not leaving your house, so they don't know anyone else, right?
Okay.
that's my take on
this. So this is getting them out of the
house. Out of the house. Right. Not necessarily, you know, becoming extroverted, right? Not being social, but definitely out the house.
Lucy has something to say. Do you have some important piece of... No, you don't have no... You have not, do not have an important piece of... I was talking to Jonathan, not Lucy. Lucy definitely has an important piece of...
No, I wouldn't count on that. But Mark, what I thought was so interesting about this was that Pokemon Go, in a way that I don't think video games specifically do, not only gets people out of the house, but it had almost eclipsed Twitter in its popularity.
Well, it did eclipse Tinder, which means people want this more than they want fast
sex or yeah. dates yeah. or love.
Right. Well, you can't get genital warts from Pokemon. So they're right
That's
away.
That's what you
advantage.
Think.
They'll solve that. Yeah, yeah. The VR people will figure out a way.
So you're saying that's an upside anyway, if in fact people could somehow or other do it in a way that made them able to engage with other people. Well, one thing you were saying or somebody was saying is if you walk past something, it will tell you that you're walking past.
Like, yeah, it sends out sort of auras or beams letting you know that you are walking past something, right?
Am I not doing
that right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does the same thing with Pokemon. The way that you know a Pokemon is near you besides actually seeing it there is that suddenly there's an aura coming off of you and off of it. And if you bounce auras, then you can connect. But you can't actually get there unless you actually get there and crossing the street and jumping hurdles and dodging cars. It'll tell you that, you know, Historic Audubon Arts District is on the left, right? Or something, a clock or something or another, it told me I was passing. And I don't know what this clock is, but I'm happy it's there now because if I wanted to pay attention to the world around me, I know that clock is there.
There was that story about the people at the United States Holocaust Museum asking Pokemon Go creators to, like, stop sending people into our lobby.
Or the Black Lives Matter protest from last Friday. A lot of people who showed up looking for Pokemon.
Right. That's what – first of all, I want to throw myself on – you should pardon the phrase – the mercy of all of you. And, like, one thing I hate being the host who didn't play the game. And that's usually not who I am. I really am usually the guy who
but
just
– today it's who you are.
Well, today that's who I am. And I think it's because –
it's an app. Download it for your phone.
Yeah, I will. I mean, I feel bad about it. I think for the last 24 hours I have done nothing but deal with really angry anti-circumcision people who have worn me down to the point where I'm incapable of extracting joy from life. So there was just – I couldn't do it. I couldn't learn a new thing. They just – yeah, I just – you know, I was spiritually circumcised by them. So I just didn't have any energy to do anything like this. So I feel really bad about it. But
Colin, you're Jewish now. We're this close to converting you if we spiritually
– I was already circumcised.
Well, you've had the
now, was it ceremonial blood or was this like a real
– No, actually, they just drained everything out of me. But I do want to say that I found out about Pokemon Go kind of simultaneously with – that there was a game that people couldn't stop playing in the context of finding out that people couldn't stop playing it in the Holocaust Museum, you know? And so that's sort of how I learned about Pokemon Go. And so I have a natural prejudice now against it, which is like the fact that we would have to tell anybody that, you know, it just seems like right away we've identified a problem here. You know, I mean, it may be a wonderful
game. I should
say
I'm not precious about these things. I mean, I don't see that sort of anything is off limits. You know, as you know, well, I'm not the token Jew in the room because we have Lucy here. But I will say, like, it's not, you know, I mean, museums and protests and whatever, like, they are permeable to mass culture.
Sure.
And I'm not offended by that. It's more just that, like, if I were organizing a protest or trying to run a museum, I would just be exceedingly annoyed by all of these people who are showing up with no interest in what's actually going on.
Well, I see the good here, right? I mean, if Nintendo or if Pokemon were interested in, you know, developing new Pokemon, right? I see, you know, the benefit here, right? If we could contact Nintendo and say, can you place a Pokemon stop here at this protest and make a whatever Pokemon that, you know, engages people in the protest, and maybe for a second while you're there. It's not, but you know, one can dream. And
maybe they could make a Hannah Arendt Pokemon who can walk you through the Holocaust Museum too. But it seems kind of unlikely.
It does.
We could swarm Trump rallies with Pokemon Go players, and it would just all be,
or
you know,
polling.
Or polling.
Yeah, I mean, this is something actually, Mercy, that is, you know, as funny as it is, I've totally fantasized about this. Like Ben Berkowitz had a great piece in Medium about, you know, what if Pokemon Go could join up with something like CClickFix in New Haven and elsewhere? So citizen journalism and reporting civic issues in real time. Mm-hmm. So what if someone playing Pokemon Go found a Pikachu that was close to a pothole cover, for instance? But also, what if we put more Pokemon by our voter registration areas
Absolutely.
And our polling places? And, you know, that's like, I think that would be very exciting. I don't think it's going to happen.
I think the CClickFix partnership is a bit scary for me as someone who just came off of a Pokemon Go high.
Because you might fall into the
right.
Well, I think also, I mean, I will now fully identify myself as the cranky old man in this conversation. But it's, you know, I mean, Martin Luther King didn't say, well, if we could just get Huckleberry Hound and the Flintstones involved, you know, we could really get the civil rights movement off the ground. Like, how much does reality need to be sweetened? You know, why can't people just do CClickFix without, you know?
Because the revolution won't be televised. It'll be tweeted, right? And maybe next it'll be Pokemon Go'd or went or I don't
so
know.
You're saying, Mercy, we've just become a deeply unserious people.
Yes.
That basically nothing is ever going to be that serious. Like, nothing will have
the
gravity and the somberness again because you 25-year-olds are going to make us play it on video games.
This is exactly why I don't tell anyone my age. Yeah.
I bet I do understand the Holocaust Museum thing, which is that mom and dad are there with the kids. The kids are obstreperous and rambunctious, and they think, oh, well, if they're playing this game, then they won't bother us. And we can walk through this museum, right? I mean, it's just we found yet another.
I actually didn't follow that story all the way out. We're little pokey people like popping up in the exhibits.
That's not
like,
how it
next...
works. Pokey people.
Like, how bad was it? Was it like next to that?
I think
pile of bones?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if the Holocaust Museum is a gym, as they call it. I would hope it's not. Is it a gym?
It's a gym, and
it is
I'm,
a gym?
I'm using. I shouldn't be using these marks because they don't mean anything for our listeners. As is the Westboro Baptist Church. There was a piece that earlier this week, and so they got into like a poke war, if that's a thing, with someone on Twitter.
I
and,
believe it's a battle.
Yeah. Okay.
Poke battle.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So you're a Pokemon translator.
Explain this more. Like, so the Westboro Baptist Church, which is like the seat of religious intolerance, right? It's like
they hold up the signs that say God hates.
Yes. Right,
they've carried
this
out
group,
to
expletives,
yes. Yes.
So do they have people running around, like, I don't know, gay people running around looking for Pokemon figures on their property?
No, they said something about how Pokemon Go, like most of, you know, the general evils in America is just leading to the complete sin and downfall of our society.
They for once might be right, but anyway, continue.
No, that's all I have to say. But then I know that there were some like Twitter wars over it. So it's this definitely is something. I mean, Colin, getting back to that email chain where you said, well, is this old news or is this not old news? This definitely is something that has permeated, if not every aspect, a lot of aspects of our society and institutions. Mark, you're absolutely right. Are not outside.
But I
want
to be clear about something here. Like, I don't know what the actual numbers are, but it actually doesn't take that many people to overwhelm the number of American Twitter users. Mm-hmm. Like, Twitter is a very niche product. Mm-hmm. Twitter is like one fraction as big as Facebook, which is genuinely pervasive. Like, old people on Facebook, young people across. Twitter is actually not like that, and Pokemon Go, I would hazard, is not yet like that either. It's that media people who read about this stuff and young people interested in video games, like there are a few groups who are reading about nothing else for the past week. But I wouldn't be shocked if my parents, who are very educated people and very with it, haven't the faintest idea what this is. I think I have neighbors on my street in my age group who are much too busy taking care of like children and dogs and, you know, mowing the lawn to know.
I was going to make that argument to Lucy, and then right away the New York Times did a page one story about this. Tom Ashbrook devoted an entire hour to Pokemon Go, and I thought, all right.
But
so
that might be the hour I turn off of Tom Ashbrook. I mean, the paper has a sports section every day that I successfully ignore every day. So.
Oh, yeah. And actually, when Mercy and I first met, we had this conversation too, which is that something can be sort of very top of mind and very top of mind for everybody you know.
Right.
But everybody you know is a very unreliable metric.
Right.
You know, everybody you know just means that you share tastes with a whole bunch of people. And it really hasn't. It doesn't have the kind of prevalence that it seems to. Well, it might be time to take a break, unless anybody has one more. I heard an intake of air.
That was me. We're good.
You were about to exhale one last
good.
Thought about Pokemon.
I just wanted to officially endorse Pokemon as the millennial in the group. Yeah? No? You're a millennial?
I'm also a millennial.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Millennial I'm typically the only millennial here, so.
It's okay, because I'm like the
you're
the
upper
moody
millennial.
You're octogenarian. Yeah. I'm like the crotchety old person
oh, okay.
in the group.
All right,
too.
So as the official millennial in the group, I officially endorse Pokemon Go. As a nostalgic sense of entertainment.
I'm trying to imagine what a crotchety old millennial is like.
It's well, you've
like
got you're, one. You've got Lucy Millman.
You're like,
yeah.
you're angry because
here.
You've never met a bank teller or something. all right. We have to take a little break. We'll come back after this.
I want to play the very best app that ever was. Just wipe them is my real test. Even if I lose my job.
Oh, welcome back. We're here in New Haven, where there really are a lot of people. Did you notice this coming in, that there were like people walking all over Temple Street?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they here for some reason? Do you know?
Well, I think there's something in the Audubon Arts District at either Coffee or the Neighborhood Music School.
Okay. It wasn't at Coffee because I was just there. All right. So maybe it's here. Might even be in this
people live here, Colin. It could be citizens.
But I'm here all regularly.
Ambulating now. Around their it's town.
It's a Pokemon gym. There's like six downtown.
So well, we're talking to Lucy Gelman. She's a reporter for the New Haven Independent and the station manager at WNHH. I bet at WNHH, when you're sitting in the studio like this, there's a visible clock somewhere, right? You can see a clock? 7 o'clock?
Usually I'm looking at my phone, yeah. actually. And there's no glass. Yeah. So it's actually, it's
weird to
have.
We have no clock in the studio. There's no clock anywhere. There's no clock visible to the public.
That could be a fundraising thing.
The only studio in America that doesn't not have a visible clock.
We'll bring you a clock,
right.
Colin.
And Mark Oppenheimer is editor-at-large for Tablet Magazine, a host of the podcast Unorthodox, which is loads of fun. I've been the token Gentile on that show. And Mercy Quay is director of communications for New Haven Public School. So I don't know. I sent this article around to everybody, and I couldn't quite tell whether any of you was really interested in it or not. But just pretend you're interested in it now. And Oppie, and I think some of you had some things to say. So this is a piece by a guy I'd never heard of before. He's a new writer at the New Yorker, Vincent Cunningham.
He started this year, yeah.
Yeah, and this is really a great piece. He's sort of talking about he was talking about Dallas and the speeches that were given by President Obama and a little bit, I think, by President Bush. I can't remember whether he mentions Bush or not. But he says he's talking about how we talk about our troubles. He says the old common American language has all but evaporated, perhaps permanently. He says, consider the responses to the mass shooting at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, in June. Within hours, talk around the tragedy had descended into a bizarre Linnaean exercise. Was this homophobia or radical Islamic terror, an occasion to decry open borders or to rail once again against irresponsible gun laws? And he goes to some interesting places with it. Maybe I can take us there and back as we go along here. But I think that he makes some interesting points, Oppie, and one of them, let's be the too crotchety, we'll be...
glad to be promoted.
Yeah, we'll be Waldorf and Statler together.
Right. They have no idea who that is. do you have any idea who Waldorf and Statler are? Yep, exactly. So just Google Muppet Show, Waldorf and Statler. So one of the claims that he makes, and this is a claim you'll see elsewhere, is that people no longer get biblical allusions, right? So that, you know, going back to certainly Lincoln before, but really people will start with Lincoln, and they'll pull us up through the present and say all the great speeches, the speeches that people talk about are politicians or preachers or activists of all different kinds. But one thing they'll have in common, whether it's King or Kennedy or going back to Lincoln or, you know, more recently, is they will pull something from the Bible and sometimes also from Shakespeare, but it's always biblical stuff. And he points out that Obama still does that, that's his style and that's his speechwriter's style. But that actually nobody gets these references anymore and they don't mean anything to anyone. This is a very, very old complaint. It is true that when Lincoln was alive, people got these references very, very quickly and they meant something to them. They kind of resonated in some deep way. It's been less true with every passing year since. So it's a kind of false nostalgia for a time when everyone was biblically literate or literate in some sort of canon. I do think that one thing that's different from when you and I were young, Colin, to today, is that back then when you had 3 channels or maybe 20 channels, but most of them were bad cable channels, you know, something happened. There was no internet. You waited for the speech. You tuned – if you were watching CBS or NBC or ABC round the clock because something big, some tragedy had happened, a Kennedy assassination. Then at some point in the next 2 or 3 days, the dignitaries got together and gave their speeches. And then those were the common texts. Everyone in America gathered around a TV or radio and had those speeches in mind. And today, of course, like that's just not true. And I actually was saying to someone recently, I have not watched a full speech in 10 years, mm-hmm. partly because they're so bad and they're all so market tested in some crappy way sure. so that they're all boring. The State of the Union addresses stretch on forever. But I literally don't listen to speeches and I love speeches. So mm-hmm. I think that we've just lost that, the fact that we're all tuning into the same events. That's my theory on it.
I mean, we live in a world where everything you say has to be caught in 140 characters, right? So right. We live in an eclipse world, not speeches. Everything, our attention span is down to I think the metric is however long it takes to watch TV between commercials, right? If that's our attention span, then it's going to be very difficult to capture someone's attention for long enough to get a lot of, you know, biblical text out, right? I mean, I think Mike is a good example of this, or BuzzFeed videos, or, you know, any of the, you know, tiny clip video production companies that have come out in the last few years. They have 30-second clips, and that's it. And you get everything that you need, whether that's, you know, a thought-provoking piece of content, right? Or if that is emotional, or if that's supposed to make you upset. Whatever that is, it happens in 30 seconds, and then you move on to the next thing.
So I have several thoughts about this, Lucy. One of them is, you know, there's when we talk about speeches, sometimes we even use the word music. You know, where's the music in that speech? And we have this idea anyway that leaders will do that sometimes. They'll find a music for us. I think it's increasingly – it happens more in the world of fiction. Abby says he hasn't listened to an entire presidential speech in a long time. I bet he's listening to Bill Pullman give the one on Independence Day, right? You know, where in fact, you know – and like people know parts of that speech, right? And he sort of misquotes –
or the monologue in Gone Girl about the cool girls, right. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
And Pullman, he kind of misquotes Dylan Thomas, but he kind of gets him in there a little bit. And you know, and we know that Aaron Sorkin can write really great speeches for presidents who don't exist. But I think increasingly what politicians and Donald Trump is the epitome of this, is to do the opposite, right? Is to find the one bass note that you could just play over and over again. I mean, Donald Trump talks to people for all of his talk about I know the best words and I have the best words. He talks and uses very, very few words and no music whatsoever because he knows that's how most people talk and think, which I find disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if we're talking about Trump, he's often, you know, incoherent a lot of the time. I actually wanted to bring this up with you and Mark, but also with Mercy, because I thought one thing that Cunningham didn't directly address in the article, or maybe could have gone into, is there's something very interesting happening around the way young people are trying to shape conversations right now. And I think in New Haven, we've had a couple protests in the past few weeks, including one that was at Varick Memorial Church on Dixwell Avenue last Sunday. And there was this discussion of biblical references, of course, because you're at a place where those biblical references are supposed to be understood. But Mercy, I'm curious, when you're thinking about language, both how did you feel about this piece? No, go ahead. Yeah.
There's some hand signals going back and forth. Mercy is giving the international signal for keep going.
Yeah. No, because I actually didn't think Cunningham was entirely fair, and maybe that's because I gave too shallow a reading to the article. But I do think when there's a
young people are always doing that.
Yeah.
Sorry. They are.
Shallow reading
those millennials. Yeah. But you know, I do think the compulsion to classify things can be problematic. But I also think that the need, especially in times of hurt and catharsis, to name an issue, which I think we see people doing in speech over and over again, mm-hmm. can be important.
It depends. I don't know what Mercy says about this, but
yeah.
I'm not even sure how to tackle this, really. I think I don't think it was unfair. I really liked the piece. I thought, if we're talking about words, I thought it was beautifully written to start off with. And he captured me because, you know, I think I've mentioned this to you before, Calvin, that I grew up in a Pentecostal church with mm-hmm. gospel and, you know, the things, all of the things. And the song Total Praise, you know, I was there when he started off. That I think that was his nut graph that he started mm-hmm. off with that, right? Mm-hmm. Total Praise was I'm getting this picture of this really huge and grandiose choir singing this beautiful song. I don't know if anyone has ever heard it, but it's a really great piece. And then I'm set into the mood of, you know, how can we bring these two, you know, in a lot of ways, polarizing ideas, and bring them into one kind of fused, pretty, you know, whatever that language comes to be, in this middle ground. You know, tying it to my thoughts on the Varick protest, I think the only thing that I thought of in comparing it to this piece is how we are interpreting the issue around, you know, All Lives Matter versus Black Lives Matter, and how I think that oftentimes people think that they are opposing ideas, right? And that, you know, if you think that all lives matter, you think that Black Lives Matter, because that typically, you know, the way that the emotion behind it, when it's ever, you know, placed in conversation, is how it is placed, right? That is how it's positioned in opposition to Black Lives Matter. But I also think that I also think Black Lives Matter is a lot of times perceived to be in opposition to All Lives Matter, which isn't the case. It's not the case at all. One can be the case for the other without the other necessarily being the case the other way around. And I mean, I guess I don't really know. I don't really know how to take it. I think that the piece was fair. I think right now, I don't want to be the spokesperson for the Black community, right? But I am the token Black on this panel, so I'll go ahead and do
that.
We're
actually going to ask you to be the spokesperson.
Yeah.
But not just the Black community, 25-year-old Black women. Yeah.
Sure, I can do that as the only 25-year-old Black woman in the room. I think that people, myself included, are sort of torn with the way the president has decided to take up these issues, the words that he's used when speaking at the funeral for the Charleston Nine, compared to the funeral, the memorial services for the Dallas, was it seven? The Dallas Five, right?
Five.
And so, I mean, I think those words, comparing those speeches in particular, you see so much, you know, the president was so convicted. You can hear his emotion during the memorial services for the Charleston Nine, and you, for that one moment, I think the Black community, or at least 25-year-old Black Black females, felt as though, you know, the president is standing in solidarity with us, and he agrees with us, right? And I think that it could have easily been interpreted the opposite, right, during the memorial services, which I don't think that's what he intended, or his speechwriters. And it's so interesting to me, the meaning that people derive from any given word.
But I think that sort of that actually flows counter. The thing that Lucy was saying about labeling, I thought was really interesting, because I think this is one of the things, and I do it, we all do it, and I've been dealing with it, once again, for the last 24 traumatizing hours, with anti-circumcision activists who, I mean, the minute you call circumcision genital mutilation, right, I mean, you sort of laid down a marker, right? You've,
sure,
you've predicated the conversation on a whole bunch of things. And we do this all the time. By the way, do you know what I'm doing to get over my incredible post-traumatic stress syndrome?
I hope getting off social media. But
well, no, I'm going after this. I'm driving to Lenox to see Merchant of Venice. What could I possibly do to make myself more upset? Anyway, that's a separate thing.
Good life choice.
But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. There's a way of laying your marker down by defining the terms, by slapping the label on it. But I think we all do it. You get up in the morning, you see the thing about Nice, and you think, what is this going to be called?
Right.
And what am I going to call it? What word am I going to find for it?
Well, and we do this in journalism. And I think I think it's problematic, and yet at the same time, I find myself doing it in articles, partly because that's what you do when you're on deadline, and just partly because I mean that's like the industry as it is. But it can be a problem to go forward and say, this is a Black Lives Matter article. This is an article about how Black and Blue lives matter. This is an All Lives Matter article, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree 100%, but I'm also baffled by the way that is furthered and reinscribed by all of my otherwise sane friends on Facebook, who every time something happens, they find a really reductionist poster or icon or avatar or quote and just put it up there. And then are like, if you don't retweet this, you obviously don't care about Black lives or female genital mutilation or anti-Semitism or the Cold War or whatever. It's like, and they think that's activism. And I'm just baffled. I'm baffled by the people who think that that's real, that means anything. And of course, and I feel like my friends who are real activists, they say this, they are the ones who say, no, 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 what's activism is like, get off Facebook, go organize, right. Go door to door, sign right. people up, bring people out. Like, and also online petitions don't do anything. So, and yet we've all bought in. I mean, we've all bought in. I mean, I haven't, but a lot of my friends feel like crying out on Facebook is a meaningful thing. And I just think it's not meaningful.
Well, when we think about things like Black Twitter, right? I don't know how many times I've heard CNN reference Black Twitter for just anything, right? Blacksit was something that came from Black Twitter. And I can think of a number of things right now. We live in a world where you do need to categorize. For what I can think of right now to be two reasons, right? Because how can you actively pursue something if you can't identify it? That's how we think about things. And how are you supposed to make a hashtag for it if you can't really, box it up in a catch-all phrase and an alliteration and that kind of thing, right? So, I mean...
But that's kind of sad, right?
It is incredibly sad, yeah. But it's also kind of...
It also does...
Well, can we use this to transition? We only have a few more minutes left in this segment, and I know all of you want to talk about the Corey Menefee story. This is the talk about sort of activism, a very different kind of activism. Corey Menefee, most people probably know this story. They're very well covered in the state by now. 38-year-old African-American dishwasher at Yale who reportedly lost his cool, broke a stained glass window in Yale's Calhoun Residential College dining hall. The window depicted slaves with two female slaves with enormous baskets of cotton on their heads. I would like to point out that it's not a bale of cotton, but anyway, with enormous baskets of cotton on their heads, somebody called the cops. He resigned from Yale. There's sort of a little bit of murkiness about sort of how all that went down. He did get arrested. The story has been playing out both in court and on the press and various places over time. I don't know. We probably have time for kind of a round the room set of takes on this, but I know Lucy, the New Haven Independent, has been covering this a lot, so you probably feel pretty well immersed in it anyway.
I do, yeah. And I have to give a really quick shout out to our team of summer interns. They've been covering the story and they've really been champs. But I think one thing that the news is missing a little bit is that Yale sort of mucked this up a lot. There was a headline yesterday in the New York Times, Yale decides to drop charges. Yeah. Well, after Yale presses charges, it's the court's decision right. to drop charges. And they will, right? Mm-hmm. It will. I think this has been mishandled. I think Salovey's letter to the Yale community really didn't address a lot of the issues at the foundation of this.
Peter Salovey.
Yes, thank you. And I really want to, since I've sort of been knee-deep in this, I really want to hear what Mercy and Mark have to say.
I've eaten in that dining hall many times. I never noticed the stained glass, but probably other people did. Apparently, it's been an issue at various points going back to the 80s at Yale when students have raised trying to get rid of that. It's apparently a uniquely offensive piece of public art. I think that breaking things is wrong. I also think that Yale should give him his job back. I think that my primary feeling about all of this has been that that it's been treated in such a legalistic way, which is everyone's talked about, well, who's pressing charges? Well, in mm-hmm. fact, the state presses charges. Mm-hmm. It's a TV fiction right. that the victim presses charges, right? So the state decided, and then they decided to drop them. Okay. The really important question here is, like, how do you handle a human being who's done something? And he says, I actually don't wish I had done it. I think this was – I think Yale could say, okay, we're not going for restitution, which they already said. Plus, why don't you come back and work here? And I think that would be a humane thing to do. I really hate the culture of firing. I hate the fact that in this country we're always saying, well, of course you're going to lose your job. Maybe we won't prosecute, but of course you have to lose your job. People lose jobs. They lose health care. Right. Their family loses health care. Like, why doesn't Yale just end this by saying, let's all agree that that wasn't an ideal scenario the way it went down. Come back and work here. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just address you've eaten that in that
It's a
dining hall?
It's a dorm dining hall.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So haven't recognized it, haven't noticed it. I think that having that lens is a big deal, right? And if you're coming in, especially with the events that have gone on across the country for the last, 5 years, right, since 2000 whenever,
yeah.
right, and the history of the country, I think if you're walking into this dining hall with that lens the entire day, which is something that he actually talked about in 2016, I shouldn't have to come. And I think this is in the article that you put together, Lucy. He says that in 2016, I shouldn't have to come into work and see that kind of stuff.
Our
right?
team of interns, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, and that's sort of like a thing, right? And for me, the way that I kind of think about it is that is on the forefront of most people's, or, you know, most of people I know, right, which is a bad measure. But most, I'll say people of color, most people who are sort of in tune to these race issues, that is the lens that you're seeing these things through. And so to kind of give you an understanding of, like, what I've thought about this is, it's the same sort of thing where people who have been tuned in all last week to the racially charged, I'll say, events that happened throughout the country, most of the people I know knew about both Alton Sterling and Philando Castillo before they knew about the Dallas shooting. Mm. But there is this other set of individuals who didn't know about any of it until Dallas happened, which is sort of how I feel about Calhoun. And this is sort of how I feel about Corey Manafee, and how, you know, you have this lens, you're carrying it with you all the time, and you walk in, and I think most students of color kind of have the same lens. They're walking in, they're seeing this, and you feel oppressed every single time. You feel like this is something that, for some reason, I'm being made to feel crazy because I care deeply about this, and it is another set of oppression that no one else cares about it. And I can understand it getting to a boiling point, especially after, you know, a full year. I know that, Colin, you've written an op-ed about, you know, a full year of Yalees protesting about this kind of thing over Calhoun, over some of the racially charged events out at Yale. I think it kind of came to a head for him. And you're right. Getting fired for this kind of thing is problematic. I think for me, the biggest issue with the whole thing is that he was charged with a felony.
Yeah.
Right. Although, can I just say a couple of things about this? First of all, to that point that you're making, when the Calhoun stuff, well, I did a piece in Salon about a year ago about the Calhoun thing. And at the time, I called my college roommate, who so we lived together for 3 of the 4 years. We're both left-handed. He's black, I'm white. And I said, did we know that this college was named after John C. Calhoun? Were we upset about this? And he said, you know, Colin, being black is a little bit like being left-handed. I mean, you don't notice all the hassles.
Right. You know? Did you bring him on the radio? I think I heard this.
No, I just quote him. So the thing I do want to say about this is I concur with pretty much everything that's been said here. Although one thing I didn't agree with, a couple of people, including I think maybe Menifee himself at one point, called this civil disobedience. Well, it's not civil disobedience. Right. When you smash something, it's not civil disobedience. And the one thing you do have to ask yourself about this, one overlay I would want to put on it is, do you want to live in a world where people smash things they don't like? Because, you know, one guy defaced the Guernica because of Milai, you know?
Well, do we have time?
Yeah, we have time.
Here's the interesting thing, right, is that whether you want to call it civil disobedience or just activism or whatever, I mean, I always turn the lens around and say, okay, what if it's some incredibly offensive anti-Semitic image that's just up there, mm-hmm. you know, with some Jew with some incredibly stereotypical, you know, Jewish depiction, and he's like counting money and he's right. And I'm thinking, like, the guy who says, or the woman who says, whether they're Jewish or not, one day, I'm just going to smash it, and does it, I give that person some props. There's some respect there.
Right, right.
But here's the interesting thing, right? If Yale had just the effect is dependent on Yale reacting to it.
Right.
And so if Yale had just cleaned it up and said, well, let's not press charges, it's a bad PR hassle, and no one had ever known, the effect wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely.
And so there's this drama that gets played out where he smashes something. I actually bet he knew what he was doing. I like to think he knew what he was doing. And I think he was smart enough, and I think he might have thought – I think it could come out in a year that he had talked to some activists and said, what could I – how could we really get something going? Mm-hmm. And then Yale reacts exactly as you'd think, which is, you know, they report it to the police. The police then do what they have to do, which is they file charges. And then all of a sudden, national episode. And I think actually, like, well, that is how change moves forward. And I actually don't believe in the slippery slope that now we're all going to be smashing things.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's also – for me, it's kind of symbolic of – this is literal broken windows theory happening before us, everybody.
I don't think that's what that phrase means. But, yeah. All right, so we have to take a break. I wish we could talk some more. I'd love to hear all of you about this. But we need a break, and we'll come back.
Roll mighty river, black mighty river, roll on. When the last rose of summer pricks my finger.
Okay, first I have to thank some people. Jonathan McNichol is the producer of the show down here in our wonderful clockless New Haven studios. Somebody's up on the board. Is Gene up on the board? Tucker? Betsy? We don't know. Somebody up at the mothership.
Nobody. Actually, nobody's on the board.
Somebody up at the mothership is doing something really good for us. Greg Hill is tweeting for us at WNPR Colin. We're on Facebook at the Colin McEnroe Show. We have a webpage, WNPR.org. The audio for this will go up there so you can parse everything that Mercy and Lucy and Abby said today. The part of Bill Curry was, of course, played by Pikachu. It's time to endorse some things, to recommend some things. We'll start with you, Abby.
So I just read a novel by my favorite novelist. Her name is Jessica Anya Blau, B-L-A-U. Her new novel is called The Trouble with Lexi. To say that it's a beach read would do it injustice, though it would do beaches great justice. It's just she writes just very wonderful books about women and stuff that happens to them in life. They're not anything more profound than that. They're
plot
just
point. Go a little quick plot point for
a plot point is this one happens to be about a prep school teacher who starts a romance with the wrong guy.
All right, name of the novel again.
The Trouble with Lexi.
Okay, because I've discovered that people listen to the title of things that we recommend and then get interested in them and then realize they don't know the title because they didn't listen that carefully. All right. So what have you got for us, Lucy?
Yeah. Jamila Woods came out with an album at the beginning of this week. She's a poet in Chicago. She works with the Dark Noise Collective. I've been following her since she was at Brown probably 6 years ago. It's called Heaven, H-E-A-V-N. And you can stream it on SoundCloud, or if you probably want to help a deserving independent artist out, you can buy it. It's really, really good. She has guest appearances from Chance the Rapper, Donnie Trumpet, and other people. It's also a really good album for this moment in the same way that To Pimp a Butterfly was.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I will. Is it my turn?
Oh, no. I thought you had two, though. You don't have,
do I have another one? So around New Haven, Connecticut, and New York, Chief Brody's Bon Me. I will say, full disclosure, I'm working on a Bon Me episode, but this takes the traditional Vietnamese banh mi and does some new things with it. The guy who runs it, Greg Martel, is really, really into pickling. So if you're into pickling or if you find yourself in a pickle.
And again, the name is?
Chief Brody's Banh Mi. And it's only a food truck. It's not a restaurant.
Okay. And when you see you're working on an episode, you mean on the radio? You're not like having an episode of some kind?
No. Okay. Although that's definitely a possibility.
That could just mean you're hungry, though.
Of Kitchen Sink on WNHH.
Okay. Mercy.
A couple things. I think brunch in New Haven, Elm City Social.
Yeah. I think you turned me on to that.
Was it? Oh, my gosh.
Because I went after. Yeah,
so you're a brunch person.
I am a brunch person. Yeah, Elm City Social Brunch is amazing.
It's on College Street?
On College Street, yeah. Right next to.
Near the reopened Anchor.
Yes.
Anchor Spa now.
Woodbridge Social has Bottomless Mimosas on the weekend for brunch. So throwing that out there. Also, local New Haven artist, Bryant Hudson. He has a Facebook page and he recently released a song sort of in response to these tragedies around the country. It's called the song is All Power to the People, and it's a great, great mix. Maxwell's Midsummer Night. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's the name of the album. Great album, which is a sequel to Midsummer's Eve, which came out almost 7 years ago. And finally, Casual, which is a Hulu original series about a brother and sister co-parenting and raising the sister's daughter.
It's a naughty show.
It is a naughty, naughty show.
We haven't seen that yet.
Can I add one?
Yeah, you can.
So The Anchor, the great bar on College Street, reopened. It's now called Anchor Spa, using the great New England term spa, which
Lucy's shaking her head
originally
meant
luncheonette. Yeah. And they really, I think they did a nice restoration job. I wish they still had the jukebox. I argued with them about that. But for all the old-time Anchor fans, give it a try. Give it a try. I guess Lucy won't be going with me.
If you have a little extra babysitting money, you know.
It got more expensive, unquestionably. Yeah. It's more. But you know what? It was unusually cheap back in the day. So
I should say I loathe brunch and I think it's disgusting. However, I do like the Elm City Social just for lunch on a Saturday. It's just a great place. I'm going to recommend. First of all, I want to double down on last week's recommendation. I was recommending Underground Airline, which is Ben Winters' new book. It's just I finished. It's just terrific. Mm-hmm. If you're into audiobooks, this guy William DeMeritt, who does all the voices, this tour de force performance on the audiobook.
So
is
did
great.
You read it or listen to
it? I audibled it or whatever you call it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I listened to it and I'm now listening to The Longest Night by Andrea Williams. This is a brand new 2016 novel set around 1960 in Idaho Falls, Idaho, where the Army was like running a lot of nuclear reactors just to sort of see if they could run nuclear reactors. And it turned out in one of those cases cases, they couldn't. Not very well. So things go wrong. Also, I'm very excited by the first episode of The Night Of, which was intended to be a James Gandolfini vehicle. He died. It's a John Turturro vehicle. It has that great noir Richard Price writing being done actually by Richard Price. So I'm only one episode into it. We may be doing a nose on it at some point because it's so good. Thank you so much, Lucy Gelman and Mercy Quay and this guy over here, Mark Oppenheimer. We will be back on Monday with coverage of the Republican National Convention, of course.
Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.